Good morning to you, Margaret.
Good morning, Deborah.
How are you today?
I'm good.
All right, great. And we're going to be missing Tom today. He is taking a unusual day off. But I've always been so impressed by the fact he puts the newspaper out on Wednesday. You used
right.
to do this also.
Right,
you'd
right,
be
right.
up until sometimes 3 in the morning.
Yes.
And he'd still show up for an analysis of the news.
A little scruffy, but yeah. he'd still show up.
Yes, he would. And here you are going to help us today to figure out what's been happening in town and give us a little insight into some things around the news.
Sure.
What strikes you, Margaret, as being what we should be paying attention to?
Well, first of all, we're still getting a new roof. So throughout the show, you may hear, because they are working directly above us this week studio.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I like to point that out. I don't know.
It is a beautiful roof.
It is beautiful dry. Mm-hmm. It's dry and warm.
Can you tell the difference already in the building by having a new roof on here?
Well, the new boiler really makes a difference. The heat is nice. On the roof, I hear that there's less leaks in certain areas.
Excellent.
And there's a couple new windows. Yes. I covered quite a few stories in Skagway this week, but to focus on Haines, let's think. We had Senator Stedman in town on the weekend, which mm-hmm. is probably the first and only time he'll show up for the election, before the election, which is fine. We're kind of a small community. You did talk about the what they were talking about, the mining claims out near Mud Bay Road.
I was just wondering if there's been any new development on that.
Well, the last I heard was from the Department of Natural Resources, and because citizens had kind of rallied and raised some concerns with the department, they looked into their records, and apparently they had mistakenly given those claims to Mr. Hosford, who's over in Skagway. So a few years ago,
who had mistakenly given
the Department of Natural Resources?
Oh, and what was the mistake?
The mistake is that they shouldn't have given him those claims. Yeah. Yeah. Seven of the claims were located within the boundaries of Chilkat State Park, which means they are actually void from inception, which means that the Department of Natural Resources doesn't have the authority to give those claims or sell those claims.
So a park overrides a mineral claim.
That's what the Department of Natural Resources is saying. Now, they're saying that he can go to the Bureau of Land Management, I believe, and see if those claims are available through them. But that reduces the claims he was talking about working on for a couple weeks and digging those trenches. That only leaves two claims that are active and available. And those two claims needed approval from the Department of Transportation to work along Mud Bay Road, which he did not have at this time. So what the Department of Natural Resources said is that his application as it was at this point was not going to be able to be approved.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. I'm not sure. The Planning Commission was supposed to discuss it last Thursday, and I was unable to make that meeting because of some other election stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe they just discussed this letter from the Department of Natural Resources and said, well, at least it brings up the issue that maybe we should all know mm-hmm. what the subsurface mm-hmm. rights are in our neighborhood and on our own property.
Yes, that was a huge learning curve.
Right.
Because, the state, meaning the government, whether it's the nation or the state or whatever, holds subsurface rights. And that's something mm-hmm. that people don't really think about when they buy a piece of ground, that you're really, generally speaking, only buying a piece of the right to live on the surface.
Right. And, yeah.
But I was thinking about gardens. I
mean, yeah. How far down can you plant
right.
if that's the case? No, it is interesting. Mm-hmm. I find it fascinating. Mm-hmm. But, it can be disconcerting if you're one of those landowners and suddenly you're.
Right. Yeah. And now you bring up the point, too, that the state had issued, the state Department of Natural Resources through mining had issued the permits. But then the BLM, that's a federal department.
Right.
And so the federal department really doesn't care about the state park issue.
Right.
So it's interesting the different layers of government that are at play in this decision. Well,
yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
That's interesting. There was, I think we touched a little bit last week on the port summit.
Right. I will point one thing out, though, that I found out this week. I hadn't done a story on it yet, but I've been talking to the mayor and the manager. Skagway actually did a fascinating story, and I cover both communities. So, but sometimes there's this crossover, and I found this little crossover this week. Skagway had solicited a study on mining, traffic related to mining between Canada and all Southeast ports. And in this study that Skagway is discussing tonight at their assembly meeting, there is actually quite a lot of reference to Haines and the kind of traffic that comes from the different mines or could come from the different mines and what kind of infrastructure is in place for all the Southeast communities in dealing with mine traffic from the Yukon.
Good job, Margaret. You found this.
Oh, it was interesting. It's a very interesting study. So, and it's online at the Skagway Borough.
And do you remember who was the
consultant? It's the Dye Management Group, DYE. So they're out of Bellingham, I think, or Bellevue.
And so the transportation infrastructure dealing with highways and port facilities.
Right.
All of that.
Yeah. Okay. Railroad. I mean, you know, Skagway's looking a little bit at rail, too, to bring in some of the mining freight. So.
One of the things I thought was very interesting on your report this morning, it was a preview about the Skagway council meeting, is they're going to be addressing a request directly to the congressional delegation for funding to AIDA. Which is a part owner of the port in Skagway.
Right.
And I thought it's so interesting the different ways that the communities approach their problem solving. And, because in Haines, we have been discussing the lobbyist issue and paying for lobbyists to do things. And in Skagway, apparently, I don't believe they have a lobbyist. And they say, well, let's write our congressional delegation and see what they can do for us.
It is interesting. It's very interesting when I cover both communities like that, because they have a lobbyist in Juneau, John Welsh, who was
in
helping
Juneau.
Them. You're right. Mm-hmm. But they are very fast compared to the Haynesboro Assembly. And that's not a criticism.
Why not?
It's just a comparison. At a special assembly meeting last week, they're talking about should the Skagway Borough invest in some upgrades to the White Pass Rail in order to help with mining being shipped through down to the port in that way, magnetite and those kind of things. They're talking about having to make a decision on whether to make a $5 to $10 million capital investment in the next 6 weeks. And I just think it's interesting that they are willing to work that fast and get, you know, put it all together. If they want to do it, they have to put it together quickly, but they're able and willing to do that. Whereas maybe in Haines, we're a little more.
It's so interesting.
Think about
longer. You bring that up because of almost precisely what we are going to be talking about today on our talking topic with Talk Around Town.
Great.
Is decision-making processes, controversial issues, and how do we approach controversy and hone our decision-making skills? So thank you for that introduction,
Margaret.
You're
welcome, Deborah.
I think one other thing that we probably need to just talk about in the news here, is there anything happening in Haines?
I know. I'm sorry. No,
okay.
The election is kind of the election is very all encompassing me right now because we're doing live coverage of the debates. But also it's fascinating with House District 34 and the Senate race, you know, with Bill Thomas and Jonathan Kreiss Tompkins and then Senator Kukesh and Senator Stedman. There's just a lot going on with that. And it's fascinating to watch. I don't think any of the candidates will probably be back in Haines before the election. But it's a big election. Both races are pretty big for Haines. And I think a lot of people are watching it. There's a lot of issues involved and just a lot of back and forth. It's fascinating,
Margaret's
but exhausting. I'm exhausted.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you. Along the ground above high tide on Portage Cove and admire that band of fireweed, well, you could be wrong. That beautiful magenta flower is faking you out. It's actually Impatiens glandulifera. It's commonly called ornamental jewelweed, and it's an invasive plant. Today we're checking in with Pam Randles of the Tokchinook Watershed Council to learn more about the impact of invasive plant species. Welcome, Pam.
Thank you, Deborah. It's good to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad you're glad to be here because I am really getting interested in invasive plants. I mostly want to talk about the invasive plant status here in Haines and why we should be concerned about it. But I just also want to note that the issue isn't just confined, you know, to flora. I've learned in my research that over $5 million was spent to eradicate the Norway rat.
Yes.
On the Aleutian Islands. That was an invasive species there. And that there is a green crab that mm-hmm. is currently threatening the commercial fisheries in southeast Alaska.
Right.
I have no idea where that came from, but or what a green crab looks like. Is it a crab that looks green?
I'm assuming. I've never seen a green crab myself. Okay. But things come in on ships' ballasts and on attached to ships, and so those waterborne things can do that. Rats are famous for doing that and getting transported all over the world. So, you know, I mean, this isn't a new issue. It's just it's reached – with plants, it's reached a fairly good size invasion in Haines.
Yeah, I want to clarify too, and hopefully you can do this for me. There's non-native plants,
right.
And then there's invasive non-native
right.
plants. Tell me what is an invasive plant?
An invasive plant is one that is aggressive enough to leave the human footprint and compete in ways that damage local ecosystems. So we get all upset about the dandelions, but they're not really that invasive. They get in our gardens, but they don't get into the forest. They don't mess with the ecosystem.
Yet.
Well, they've had like 50 years here, so I'm assuming that if they were going to, they probably would have by now. Mm-hmm. But we got a new one this year that has exploded, reed canary grass, and it likes little streams like Sawmill Creek. Mm-hmm. And so that it grows into those streams and chokes them off, and then the young fish can't grow there. The salmon, the Dolly Varden, the cutthroat trout. Mm-hmm. And so then that's when we start talking about invasive, is when it impinges on local ecosystems or impinges on agricultural crops and, you know, outcompetes native plants or agricultural crops that we're trying to grow.
I was recently reading, I found out there's volumes and volumes of stuff written about
yes.
it. Mostly, and you know, it's intriguing. It's very scientifically based. I found almost all the literature is developed by research people, scientists working at the University of Alaska, and then employed by the Forest Service and there's a couple of the extension services, I guess.
Yes, cooperative extension.
Yeah,
yes,
they're
right.
University based. But the thing that intrigued me, I just read last night, was that some non-native plants can be introduced, and there's a lag time, and it can be up to sometimes a decade before that plant actually gets into what then becomes an exponential growth period. And
that's
like
true.
With the canary grass.
Right.
Okay. You just say it just got introduced this year?
Well, no, it went wild this year. It reached that exponential.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's been here in small amounts, but the conditions were just perfect. One of the things reed canary grass can do is hybridize with local plants. And then when it does hybridize with local grasses, it increases its ability to adapt to this particular environment. And then boom! It's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And yes, that does happen. There's a time when this plant that's coming from someplace else has to adapt to our local situation. But it doesn't bring its predators, and it doesn't bring its diseases.
And that's, I guess, the issue.
That's the issue.
Because really, plants, I suppose, and species have been roaming around the planets for as long as the planet's been around.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
So
oh, yeah.
It's always in a state of invasiveness, but it's just whether it chokes out and impacts the environment in such a way that something is disturbed.
Yeah, there are negative consequences.
So
fireweed, willow, alder, they're all very aggressive plants. But they are also plants that live here. They have things that eat them, diseases that keep them in check, keep them in control. Whereas the ornamental jewelweed, which looks as pretty as the fireweed, doesn't have that.
Yeah, it was interesting for me all summer long. I just thought, oh, look at that fireweed growing down there.
Yeah.
And then I went down to the beach and I thought, oh my goodness. I mean, I felt almost ill to my stomach. And let's talk about the other plant that I've been aware of, because I go down on the beach, you know, with my dog. And as a kid, we would kind of always go through the rose bushes to get to the beach, you know, those thorny little things. But now there's a new plant, the Canadian.
Yeah, well, Canada thistle. It's been rechristened creeping thistle. Mm-hmm. Canadians got upset about it because they said that it didn't come from them. It came from us. And actually, it came from the old world. So, you know, they're right in that sense. It's not a Canadian origin. But.
So, yeah, that has, I see that everywhere. And this summer, I actually started pulling some of it myself just out of frustration because I just didn't want to see that impede my ability to get to the beach. I could see that in 5 or 10 years, I would not be able to get through the bramble briars.
Yeah.
So tell me then, Pam, what are you doing professionally with Talk Chinook?
Well, our sort of locally immediate, most immediate goal is to try and form a community weed management association and find funding for a staff person. That would be a volunteer board that maps and assesses the problem and prioritizes what we need to do. There's a lot to do in Haines, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And so we need to prioritize what's the most important stuff to do and then mobilize people to do those things. That includes things like weed pulls or tarping or, in some cases, spraying. Sometimes that's your only option. And if you're careful, spraying. Oh, okay. And it is possible to do it carefully and in ways that don't leave residual poisons in the soil. Mm-hmm. So, but there needs to be a sort of community-wide effort to deal with that. And so that's what we're working toward at this point. But in the meantime, we've had students that have done weed pulls. We had a community weed pull for spotted knapweed. Actually, that's a success story. Spotted knapweed is a very aggressive plant and was discovered here. Greg Palmieri figured it out about 5 years ago and found two spots, and Greg and I have been on those two spots, and then a new spot showed up this year by the airport, and so we had a pull. So as of right this minute, there's no knapweed in Haines. There's none.
Okay, I didn't know I should be concerned about knapweed. So tell me why should I be concerned about knapweed?
Because it's very aggressive. You know those ones that some.
What does it compete with?
It with roadside grasses, and it goes, you know, into the roadsides and then off into people's lawns and stuff. You know that one, the blue one that some people call bachelor's button. That it's got really small petals. It's domestic plant that grows on the hillsides all over here. A lot of people have it planted in their garden. Uh-huh. That's a knapweed too. That's the same type. And it just goes wild and it just grows and grows. Then the clover gets outcompeted. Well, clover contributes nitrogen to the soil and makes the soil richer. And knapweed does not.
Oh, okay.
And so then we start, you know, it starts outcompeting these plants that are beneficial and part of the system.
So you just named one.
Yep.
Name a non-native invasive plant other than dandelion that you don't care about, and then name something that you really care about. Like, what are the top three plants, invasive plants, that you think that we need to be concerned with?
Well, we sort of have the top six here in Haines, unfortunately. Uh-huh. There's a ranking system from 1 to 100, and we've got several that are above 80. Just to give you and one of them is reed canary grass, one is ornamental jewelweed, one is Canada thistle, one is orange hawkweed, and I know there's a bunch of listeners out there going, yeah, I know, because it invades their lawn. Yeah, another one is white sweet clover, which is, you know, working in at the Letnikoff dock. There's some of us who are trying to keep that from coming in there. That was brought in to be pasture plant for raising agriculture in Fairbanks. Now it's here, and it smells wonderful, and it's a great forage plant, and it outcompetes the native plants for pollinators. It grabs all the pollinators so the fireweed doesn't get pollinated and therefore doesn't reproduce.
Well, thank you very much, Pam, for, you know, helping to bring this forward. And I know that, you know, I kind of glanced a couple of years ago at the invasive species display, you know, at the fair. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, that's a kid's. I just thought, oh, that's just a 4-H project. But since I've, you know, learned more about it and alarmingly, you know, in my own experience, walked into these things, I realize that it is something that we really do need to pay attention to, or the world that I grew up in, you know, is not going to be the world that other people do. And I suppose that's okay, because I grew up in a different world on some levels, but you kind of.
But
appreciate.
You don't want it to get to the point where it damages your fish or damages your moose forage. Mm-hmm. You don't want those things to go away.
Right.
And so let me put a little plug in here.
Absolutely.
If people are interested in working on that, please call us at the Watershed Council. We're looking to form this group to try and get some of these things going.
Okay.
And we need the help of the community. It's got to be a community effort. There's too much out there otherwise.
I understand totally. Well, and I do want to just say before we close out that I would like very much to acknowledge this summer that we did have borough staff, especially Laverne. She was out there, bless her heart, pulling,
DOT is working to inform themselves so that when they mow, they're killing invasives rather than spreading them. You have to time it right. If you mow when they're in seed, you just carry stuff up and down the highway.
Right.
And so, we can, those kinds of informing yourself though, and doing things in ways that don't spread the problem, but actually help decrease the problem. That's what we need to do.
Right. Well, I also think back to how much damage I may have done as a kid around Haines. They have kids pull flowers. They're beautiful. You use them to make mud pies with them, and you take them from here to there. And
oh,
all
and dandelions. And you pull them and blow the seeds.
Right.
Look what the favor you've done that dandelion.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Pam.
Yes, you're welcome.
It's 23 minutes after 10 o'clock, and you are listening. Then you can hear me that way. Okay. Deborah didn't have the right button pushed. Thank you. I think I'm back on again. Thank you. My guests can hear me. My audience can hear me. And here we are and Talk Around Town this morning at 10:23. Several weeks ago, the community learned that a photographer that was scheduled to present to a school assembly was pulled off the calendar under a provision that allowed for censoring controversial topics. So it got me thinking about the definition of controversy and the value of controversy. And I've invited two people to explore this with me in the context of our community. Anne-Marie Palmieri, president of the school board, president of the board of the Haynesboro Public Library, and also serving on the school board. She's a mother and a scientist by profession, I would say. And welcome, Anne-Marie, for coming on the show today.
Thanks for inviting me.
All right. And Gershon Cohen, an activist primarily in environmental issues and also a debate coach here in Haynes, teaching our local students how to argue both sides of an issue successfully. Welcome, Gershon.
Thank you.
All right. There's a big, big, broad topic called communication, and it includes conflict resolution, debate, getting to a decision point. And when the school's policy regarding controversial issues came up, I was struck by the idea that, controversy really is necessary to decision making. I mean, without controversy, then decisions just really aren't required. They just kind of go hand in hand. And it started me thinking about the problems oftentimes that we see in our community on a political level, whether it's a school board or the borough assembly or whatever, just being able to make decisions. Gershon, I'm going to ask you, do you think that we're controversy adverse?
Here in Haines?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't think we're controversy adverse at all.
Okay.
I think that we generate far more controversy than we need to. I think that that's I think that we do that in a number of ways, and actually we violate some of the really classic rules of communication if people want to avoid controversy. One is, and I'll just start off with this just because of the way you introduced me, we label people. And so when you label people, you bias the public to what they're about to hear. And so when I am going to be speaking...
your introduction was loaded, wasn't it?
My introduction was totally loaded. And so when people, you know, people who either don't know me or people who do know me, they hear that, oh, he's an environmentalist or he's an activist or he's an advocate or something like that. Many people will just dismiss out of hand what I'm about to say. And so I think there's a real difference between introducing people based on their qualifications. Like you said, Anne Marie is a scientist and a mother and various things. These are not labels as much as they are identifiers mm-hmm. of who she is and what her background is. I would prefer that when I'm introduced that my background and my experiences
You're
are
absolutely
whether,
right.
You know, rather than
what I did. Yeah.
rather than labeling me in a mm-hmm. way that's going to turn mm-hmm. half the people in town off to my message. So mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. that's one thing.
And so let's go back for just a minute. I could have said, and I've invited Gershon Cohen as a science-based you're also in a science-based profession as a I guess a marine biologist?
Molecular biology
okay.
and environmental
okay.
policy.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
okay. And I think because of that, because of the fact that you do – here I go. I'm already going to go on the bent that professionally your employment has taken you into areas that are of public policy issues and therefore you do, I guess – debate.
That's correct. And that's very true. And I certainly don't, I'm not trying to sidestep that. But okay. at the same time, we're also we all have very diverse backgrounds. Mm-hmm. I was also a potter here for 14 years.
That's right.
And working as an artist. So, you know, there are a lot of dimensions to all of us. And I think it's more important that we hear what we each are trying to say rather than be focused on who we think these other people are.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one issue. A second issue is that, this gets really to the core of, say, what we try to do with the debate team at the high school, mm-hmm. is that I think often in our community, when we are about to discuss an issue, we sidestep some really important steps. Mm-hmm. And they
Could you
are,
hang on to those, though? Because I'd like to come back to that. I don't want you to, you know, fill up the whole first 5 minutes of the 25 minutes with all the lessons learned. Because I want to come back just to pull in for my own information and for all of us for whom this controversy. Apparently, the school does have a policy on controversial issues. Is that correct, Anne Marie? Correct me if I'm wrong. If I'm not seeing this right.
Well, that is true. There is a board policy on controversial issues. So,
and what does it mean?
And the policy states that if a controversial issue is brought up, that all sides of the issue would be presented at an assembly or you know in a forum mm-hmm. there. So,
and that's kind of how the radio station adheres to that to some degree. Also, if somebody wants to come and present a point of view, then they have an obligation to at some point in their programming to present the other point of view.
Right. So. And I think it's important to note, well, first of all, I'm not here on behalf of the school board.
No, I understand.
Right? I mean, I'm here mm-hmm. as a mother and as a person.
But you do have influence in how these things. And I do want to point out that it was my understanding that you did at the meeting raise the issue of who decided that this particular issue was controversial. And I think that's part of the problem, part of that issue.
Right.
You know?
Well, I think
what
I
is
think
controversial?
Yes. And I think the issue, the salmon in the trees issue at the school, I think is part of a broader issue, which is how do we determine what is appropriate for a school-wide assembly? Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's a broader policy issue. What's the process? What are the criteria? And who's going to make that decision? Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that we need to look at, you know, from a board perspective, you know, and give some criteria to the administration so that they have that, so that they can make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
But thinking about a controversial issue, and you and I actually had this conversation a couple of days ago.
Colin, if you can hear that thumping on the roof.
So, you know, those are really the traditional ones being religion, sex, and politics, you mm-hmm. know. And so I was thinking about why issues become controversial, and I think it's because we as people right, for right or wrong, tend to define ourselves in certain ways. And these are things that we, you know, that we believe in and that, you know, as Gershon was saying, labels that we put, you know, on other people or on ourselves. Well, you know, maybe someone's a Republican or a Democrat or an environmentalist or a, you know, non-environmentalist, whatever that label is.
Right, and that's part of the problem, too, is that everyone has their own definition of what that label means.
That's right.
And so if somebody says, I'm a Democrat, and they say it to somebody whose idea of a Democrat is totally different than me, who has my, you know, label, my own definition, you get into problems immediately just by having that label.
Right, and then you get that, that kind of feeling in your stomach that starts to, you know, happen where all of a sudden the emotions and the passions start to rise. And I think that's where people, the critical thinking breaks down, mm-hmm. and the communication, mm-hmm. breaks down those discussions.
Right. And I think that is the word issue and controversy, I mean, they kind of go together. Issue doesn't imply that there's more than one way of looking at something. There's more than that there's conflicting or combating or what am I trying to say here? There are things that need to be resolved. That's what makes it an issue. Is that not correct?
No, I wouldn't say that's what makes it an issue. I'd say that's what can make it a controversy.
Okay.
There's an implication in the word controversy that you've got different viewpoints. An issue is just anything to be discussed. You may bring an issue up before people and find that everybody's on the same page and moving in the same direction. That's still an issue, but it's not a controversy.
Okay. Okay.
So one doesn't apply the other.
So controversies develop then when there are issue, when there are sides or perspectives, mm-hmm. that may be in conflict.
Well, and I think that, you know, Anne-Marie raised an interesting point, you know, and you actually brought it up first, and that is who decides what, mm-hmm. is a controversial topic for the school, say, mm-hmm. in the context of what's, mm-hmm. happened here in the last couple of weeks. And I went back, I was looking through the policy, and it's not very clear, really, as to how we determine what is going to be considered a controversial topic. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if there are people out there who still think the earth is flat, you know, to have it being taught in the school that the earth is round, that's going to be controversial to some people. Mm-hmm. Well, according to the policy, anything that could be brought into the school that could elicit that type of reaction from someone in the community, mm-hmm. could be defined by the policy that the school now has, mm-hmm. as being a controversial topic, which then triggers all of these other things about having equal time and having this and that. And it doesn't say equal time at the same time, or if it's equal time in a different, mm-hmm. you know, in a different, mm-hmm. venue. Mm-hmm. One document says that the instructor shall decide what's appropriate for the classroom, and another document says the principal shall decide. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it kind of gets to what I was going to mention before, that we don't define terms. And this is one of the things that we do in debate. One of the first things you do in a debate is you have to get to a common ground with your opponent. You have to define terms, mm-hmm. so that at least you're arguing about the same thing. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't do that, then you're not going to get anywhere. And that's often what we do in this town. We don't define what we're really talking about. Mm-hmm. We don't define the terms. We don't define the facts. Mm-hmm. We don't lay out and say, okay, here's a set of facts, and we're going to all start from here. And where we might want to end up might be very different depending on who we are, mm-hmm. and what we like. Mm-hmm. But we have to agree on a basic set of facts and a basic set of term definitions, mm-hmm. or talking is just going to lead us around like a, you know, lead us up the Tower of Babel.
Which I think oftentimes we do. There are many issues, controversial issues, that sit in this community for years and years and never get decided, mm-hmm. because we don't want to or can't somehow pull ourselves together to figure out who should have the conversation, who decides what they're, you know, or what we're going to be talking about. One of the things that really intrigued me about the salmon in the trees issue, I guess we're going to call it that, the salmon in the trees issue, is that this school presentation apparently was sponsored by the U.S. Forest Service in many, many communities in the Tongass National Forest. And it's only in Haines that it became a point or an issue. So it leads me to wonder, is everyone else just blindly doing what the government says to do, and only Haines is the group of people that get, you know, analytic about things and say, hey, you know, there's something here that needs to be addressed and we're going to address it? Or have we carried something maybe too far?
But I think, Deborah, it's important to note that Amy Gulick is actually going into the school, into individual classrooms. I know yesterday she was at Mark Fontenot's classroom and she gave her presentation there. And I believe she's going to be in the fourth grade. I talked with, because my son's in the fourth grade, and I talked with Patty Brown, and Patty said, oh, yeah, we're going to, you know, ask her to come in. So I don't know if that's actually been scheduled, but I know that Patty Brown was wanting her to come in and talk to the fourth grade, because they are studying Haines and Haines economy and, you know, kind of the White Horse and Skagway and Carcross area. They usually take a field trip in the spring going to White Horse and Carcross. So that's a relevant topic for them to be talking about. So the determination was that that the presentation would not occur at a school-wide assembly.
That everyone would stop doing what they were doing, the normal course. Okay.
And I've talked with Michael Beyer and about scheduling, just in a general way. And the school actually doesn't have school-wide assembly slots. So if there is going to be a school-wide assembly, then the administration has to figure out, okay, where are we going to put that, and how are we going to fit that into everybody's day?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot going on
right.
at the school,
and for teachers
and all
that
those
have
different
the syllabus all figured out, and this is a disruption,
or,
and they have to make up for it later.
Or kids that are traveling, you know, and so the high school kids travel a lot with, you know, different activities.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of that is more of an organizational effort that needs to happen at the school. And so that's why, you know, I brought up earlier that I think that it's part of this bigger, topic of school-wide assemblies and how that happens and what the criteria are. And when
it might be a misnomer then to say that we have a controversial issues policy.
Well,
a possibility?
When
because how do you decide what's controversial?
Well, that's a personal question. I think everybody, you know, as Gershon was saying, I mean, you know, an issue might be controversial to someone and not to someone else.
Right. So I mean, I'm asking it in terms of if we were the school board right now sitting here and saying, okay, how valuable is a controversial issues policy? I question whether or not it's even a manageable policy.
Well, that
doesn't seem to me like it's even manageable. It creates controversy in itself.
Well, that's why I think, you know, it would be good for the school board to look at that and also to look at, you know, the assembly, you know, and the policy right now for the school says that it's a decision that would be made by the administration, but not by the school board, because the administration, I mean, they're in touch with, you know, the day-to-day happenings at the school. And I think that's appropriate, is that it should be that decision should rest with the administration.
Okay. And I'd like to stay with the school for a little bit and go back now, Gershon, to what you wanted to bring up before. And that is, we're talking about teaching, training brains to be critical, to think critically. How, as a debate coach or somebody involved in teaching students about communication, what are the rules, other than, as you've said right now, define your terms? How do you approach teaching critical thinking? The roof just fell off. Hello?
Well, okay, so the first thing that we do when we get a resolution, right? We get a resolution to debate every month, or, you know, for each meet. And the resolutions either are drawn up by the coaches in Southeast, or sometimes we use a national topic, but one way or the other. It's always been amusing to me. I've been doing this a long time, and it's always been amusing to me how when we first see the resolution, we put it up on the whiteboard, and everybody reads it over 10 times to themselves. And almost everybody in the room will immediately have a visceral reaction that, that, oh, I couldn't possibly argue the negative of this side of the debate because it's so obvious that, you know, the affirmative side is going to win the debate. And and it is so funny to me how often by the time we finish and we're ready to go to the meat and debate, we've either switched sides in our own for our own personal viewpoint or we have become so disarmed in our ability to defend the one that we really that we realize that and in fact and this is another misnomer there's this idea out there that there's two sides to every issue. There aren't two sides to every issue. There's about 10 or 15 or 20 sides to every issue because there are not sides. There are just a whole variety of sub-points, and some are stronger and some are weaker depending on who you are and what your background is and what you believe is important. And so when we look at these resolutions as a team, we try to figure out, okay, look, we know we're going to have to debate both sides because the kids have to, you know, they flip a coin at the beginning of the match and that tells them which way they're going to go. So they know they have to go to the meet prepared to be able to debate both sides of every resolution. And to do that, you really have to believe that there are some valid points or you just are not going to be an effective debater. And so we strive to find the points that support one position versus another position. And I think to me, one of the reasons I do this is that it teaches these kids that in fact the world is not so black and white. And that it is really important to not be intellectually lazy and be willing to, you know, bring these facts to bear in your own lives and so that you can make decisions that reflect the complexity of issues that we really have in this world, be in the community or statewide or nationally.
Well, listening to you, I think of the format of debate that allows for presentation of arguments, then back and forth, and there's the exchanges, maybe six of them or something like that, well, depending what the format of the debate is. In our public process, and I know Anne-Marie, you can speak to this also, but I know that as an assembly member, oftentimes you're called to give your position on an issue. And oftentimes because of that, you know, it's like you're being allowed to speak. You have the floor. You only get it once. And
it's
you, it's a choking experience. It really is because you can't put everything in. You don't think of everything. Somebody else will come up with something else and you'll change or you'll say, oh my God, that's, I hadn't thought about that. And now I think this because of that. And so what really happens inside of a person's mind while you're, while it's struggling with and thinking critically, the format, if the format doesn't allow for that, you just end up being so disappointed with the outcome.
That's a very, very good point, Deborah. This whole system that we unfortunately have adopted at this point of, you know, giving someone 3 minutes in front of a microphone with no opportunity for rebuttal, with no opportunity for exchange with with the elected officials is actually, and this is a topic for another discussion on another day perhaps, but it's a system that was actually not really put into place to give the public a real say. It was a system that was put into place so that the powers that be could say, we gave you an opportunity to participate, because it's really meaningless to a great degree, just for the reasons you just pointed out.
Right, but that's interesting. So you're responding to what I said as a member of the public that's speaking to a decision-making body. I'm talking about being on the decision-making body and having that, you know, this everybody gets their time to talk and then, oops, we, you know, you've already said your point. You know, we already know what you think. Now let's let somebody else say, and all right, now you're ready to vote? You know what I'm saying? And you just, I just oftentimes will feel lined up, you know, against a decision wall. And it's like, now I'm told that only knowing what you know right now, feeling how you feel right now, vote. And I'm thinking, but I'm not done yet. You know, I'm not ready yet, you know, to move on. And I don't know, Anne-Marie, can you speak to that? You're kind of shaking your head. It does happen.
It does happen. And there have been instances, you know, in different boards that I've been on where, where we've had conversations and people, as you said, people bring up things that you hadn't thought of. And you say, wait a minute, can we think about this? Can we just talk about this a little bit more before it's time to actually call for the question?
Right.
So, but I wanted to get back to what you were saying about critical thinking, you know, and I know I've had this experience with my own kids. They're studying the Constitution and elections right now in social studies. And so my seventh grader came home and they'd been talking about Republicans and Democrats and what they believe. And they'd had this discussion in class about, you know, who believes what. And really, Gershon, as you were saying, I mean, it's not black and white. It's complex gray. And I think the best thing we can do is start asking the question, why? So, well, why do you believe that? So let's talk about gun control. That's what Keegan and I were talking about. And I said, so why do you, you know, well, why do you believe that? And he said, well, this is what I believe. And I said, well, why? Is it because that's what I believe? And that's what you've heard in our household? Or is there something else? And he said, well, you know, my classmate said this. And it was a great exchange. And it was wonderful to watch that spark, you know, of that critical thinking where he was actually, you know, coming up with his own beliefs. Of course, you know, I had to push and keep saying, so why? So why do you believe
because
that?
It's so easy to grab onto opinions, and opinions also are very attractive sometimes by who's presenting them and how they're presented. I mean, we all know the phrase getting sucked into, you know, somebody else's stuff because of the way it's presented, or we get mesmerized or whatever, but we don't stop and ask that question like, why is this, you know, why am I even reacting the way that I'm reacting sometimes?
And
it resonates, I guess, with something that's really internal from childhood a lot of times.
Right. And I thought it was important that he was a little upset because his opinion was different than one of his friend's opinion. And he goes, well, you know, everybody else, you know, thought this other way. And I said, well, you know, and so we had our discussion in a calm, safe environment. Just, you know, I was making dinner and he was doing his homework. And so that was it was safe for him. You know, so I think in a lot of controversial topics, the reason it can escalate is because people get upset and they get that kind of fight or flight mentality.
Very much so.
Oh, yeah.
And then,
you're very right.
You know, because the environment, so, you know, I start talking with Gershon here and I start to get upset and then, you know, his back goes up just because, you know, of the perception of how the other person is talking to you. And it feeds. That feeds into the fact that then all of a sudden we're not communicating.
Well, it's really interesting, and we have to wrap this up pretty soon, but I think that what you've brought up here is that the issue of safety. I can feel oftentimes in an assembly meeting when things are not safe anymore. You know, I can feel it in the room when sometimes even just a certain individual has to stand up and say they want to speak, and you can feel people go, So respect and safety, I think, probably are, two of the things that we need in the community to try to work on those, creating those environments for people so that we don't retreat to defensiveness.
Well, and as I say, you know, I think an important aspect of that is to not prejudge, is to not, you know, shoot the messenger, as they say, right? And and to really hear what people say and try not to go with the labels that, you know, and believe that you know where they're coming from and you know what they're about. And just the fact that that person said it, well, that must not be my position because of look who's supporting it. And that's what we need to try to get away from as a community. It doesn't do us any good.
Right. Well, I like the fact that you said prejudge as opposed to using the word prejudice, because you use the word prejudice and immediately, you know, you even have a reaction to that word. But when you say don't prejudge, it's much more thought-provoking. Like, what does that mean? It's same as prejudice, but God forbid I'm not prejudiced. But do I prejudge? You bet I do. So it's really interesting. This has been great. Thank you very much for helping me to create more safe and respectful environment in our political and public discourse. Thanks very much for being with me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
listening to Talk Around Town on KHNS, your community radio station, and we're up to everyone's favorite part of the show. My name is
Jedediah Blumevitz.
Hi, Jedediah. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi. This is the time of the show where we just invite somebody from the community to come and tell us about themselves. And this is your 5 minutes, Jedediah. What would you like us to know about you?
What to know about me? I don't know. Friendly guy. I'm originally from Maine, which could be interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, most of my Alaska time has been here in Haines. I've been here for just a little under 3 years.
Where would most people find you?
Most people find me?
Yeah.
Probably the library.
At the library.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they're part-time as well as a couple other part-time things. But.
And Jedediah, the tall, dark-haired guy in the library. What is your position there?
Technically the librarian aide. Mm-hmm. So I do what most of the librarians do, and I do a lot of fill-in for people when they're mm-hmm. gone. And then I'm the one that does most of the book mending there.
Oh, okay.
So all the books that everybody wears out over time or uh-huh. the children rip and that sort of thing, I get to do what I can to fix okay. those or make them last a little
Are
longer.
Are you a bookmaker by profession?
Maybe now.
Uh-huh. Okay, great. So what brought you from Maine?
Growing up, I always wanted to move to Alaska. Just got inspired when I was a really little kid. My parents were convinced someday it would happen.
Did they come with you?
No, they came and visited twice now. But, but
twice, and you've been here
almost 3 years. Yep, and they've been up and visited twice.
All right, so
it's a long way for family separation.
Absolutely. So, did you grow up in Maine in an urban environment or out in the on the coast? Or?
I grew up in northern central Maine in a town smaller than this one.
Wow, so you've moved to the big city.
I moved to a town almost twice the size of my hometown.
Do you remember what it was when you were a kid that that made you want to come to Alaska?
Well, I was always into the just subsistence living and that sort of lifestyle and that sort of concept. And whenever I brought that up, people always ended up mentioning Alaska. And as a little kid, I'm sure the connection became really strongly made.
Mm-hmm. So are you subsisting here?
I do a lot of foraging.
Uh-huh. Yeah, are you a mushroom man?
I am a mushroomer.
Wow.
This was a great fall for mushrooms.
I've heard that. I see the mm-hmm. evidence of it all
yeah,
over
I've
the place.
I've had a lot of fun collecting right. and uh-huh. teaching people and just spending time out in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
I went on my first mountain goat hunt this fall, and that was a lot of fun.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
How high did you climb?
Almost to the top of whichever mountain that was.
And did you see any goats?
We did. We got a goat.
All right.
Yeah,
good for
it was
you.
A good hike.
I also, a little bird told me that you're a birder.
Yeah, this is yeah. true. I'm wildlife ecologist by schooling.
Okay.
And so anything to do with the outdoors and wildlife really interests me. I've done a bunch mm-hmm. of research, but birding has been a major part of that. And just learning birds and how they live, where they live, why they're there, mm-hmm. what they look like, and how they sound. And all those things are interesting.
Of course, I have to ask you to
sure.
do your favorite bird sound.
you want me to whistle over the rail? All right.
Sure. Mm. I mean, whatever one intrigues you, I guess, you know.
Well, I'll do the most common one I do, and people are likely to hear it and go, oh, Jed's there.
Oh,
if they hear it,
really?
A lot of people okay. actually just connect.
Okay.
So that one's the one people are most likely to hear.
I thought I looked around for the little bird. I bet everybody did. Do it again. And what is the little bird?
Well, actually, that one, if you were to go through all the birds and listen in and try and figure it out, that one probably sounds the closest to a canary.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
okay.
Just your everyday kind of pet little yellow bird.
Okay.
But so usually for bird imitating like that, I would listen to a particular one to do it. That one's just the one that's automatic.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any bird sounds that are that have those long kind of trailing syncopated at the end?
Things like that?
Yeah.
Trills, yeah.
And who was that?
let's see. The higher pitch one would sound a lot like a junco. So they have mm-hmm. that steady trill, and then they do it in bursts. So they'd be like, so they do that. Mm-hmm. And then you can get the deeper ones, and you can make that sound like a loon laughing or that sort of thing. It's just,
oh, could you do a loon?
I could, sort of. So it's more a matter of the pattern of the sound than the mm-hmm. actual matching the exact notes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So let's see if I can do it. So So a loon will hear that and they'll respond with
their
laugh.
Oh, here comes one right now.
Yeah, through the window.
Well, that's so intriguing. And do you like go to the woods and listen and then teach yourself by mimicking, or do you practice with recorded bird sounds?
I definitely have recorded bird sounds, and I use those more just to learn what bird I'm hearing when I go out into the woods. But actually practicing whistling, I just do that. When I hear a bird, it whistles, and then you try and mimic it. Mm-hmm. And like I said with the loon one, it's a matter of the pattern matching up more than it is the tones having to be right. So if you get the right pattern, they'll copy you and do it back.
Very cool. Yeah. Very cool. You could have Jedediah's School of Bird Sounds. Wouldn't that be cool? You know, a community. I'm going to hook you up with John Hagen. He's looking for people who have interesting things to teach people. That would be really great.
It could be a fun little thing.
It could be a fun, fun little thing. That's right. Yeah. Anything else, Jedediah? I mean, that certainly is more than enough, but I just thought as long as it's your 5 minutes, if there's something else you'd like us to know about you. Are you a tightrope walker or anything like
that? No tightrope walking. Tried slacklining like twice. It's a challenge. It's fun.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. All right. And you, Haines is now your home?
Haines is now my home.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jedediah Blum-Levitz. You'll find him at the library or in the woods. Tickets to hear the astronaut speak at the Bald Eagle Festival are still available at the American Bald Eagle Foundation. And tonight at Harriet Hall, there's a photographic exposition, Salmon in the Trees. It's a potluck, and it's at 5:30, and it is free. Tomorrow night from 7 to 9, again at Harriet Hall, we have a wine tasting event to benefit the Southeast State Fair and Friends of the Library. And then on Saturday morning, a guided tour with Pam Randles and Amy Gullick, and that's to benefit the Alaska Chilkoot Bear Foundation and the Alaska Arts Confluence. If you're interested in that, 766-2876 is the number to call. And that's it for Talk Around Town this week. Thanks to our guests, Anne-Marie Palmieri and Gershon Cohen, Pam Randles and Jedediah Blum-Levitz. The next edition of Talk Around Town will be November 1st. Stay tuned. This is Station KHNS, 102.3 FM, Haines, translating in Skagway.